Move up Senate Committee on Business and Transportation for Wednesday, February 18th. Let's open a work session on Senate Bill 50. Why don't you bring us up to date, Mr. Stembridge, and then we'll have a few folks come up and talk about the amendments and what they think about it.
You've worked this twice. Senate Bill 50 extends the deadline for notice of claims from labor supplier on public contracts. You had the dash, you worked this on the 26th and the 5th of February, the 26th of January. The current amendment restores existing provision on employee benefit plan contributions, extending claim filing deadlines for employee benefit plan contributions from 150 to 200 days. We have fiscal statements on the Dash 2 amendment which say no expenditure impact, no revenue impact.
Okay. So who do we have that wants to come up and talk about those amendments? We have a couple people I know at least. And just kind of give us your thought of whether we've come up with something here.
Start. Chair Metzger, members of the committee, my name is Christine Hammond. I'm the administrator of the Wage and Hour Division of the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries, and I testified on January 26th in support of this bill. Again, the purpose of this bill is to extend the deadline for filing a notice of claim against a contractor's payment or prevailing wage rate bond on public works projects. And the reason behind this is that we often find that 120 days from the last date of an employee's work is not sufficient for us to gather information to file a complete notice of claim. So the concept was to extend that deadline period for 180 days. At the time we first came to the committee, the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee had asked us to also consider tying the deadline date to the date of a project's substantial completion. And we spent some time trying to nail down language that was acceptable to everybody with regard to that timeline, and found that it was problematic in coming up with a definition that applied to all sorts of projects when it came to determining when a project was substantially complete. So we're no longer pursuing that language or that amendment, and everybody that was involved in exploring that is in agreement that that's not a good way to go. When we first proposed amendments to Senate Bill 50, we propose combining the timeline for filing a claim for unpaid wages with the timeline for filing a claim for unpaid fringe benefits. And those dates previously were different. The notice of claim deadline for wage claims was 120 days, and the claim deadline for fringe benefits was 150 days, and we had proposed making them the same, 180 days. This gentleman next to me will be talking about why some people still want to keep the deadlines different for the fringe benefit deadline for filing a claim against the bond, and the Bureau has no objection to that amendment.
We go ahead.
For the record, Brian Krieg. I'm here representing the Sheet Metal Workers, Local 16, SMACNA Contractors, and the contractors of PMCA. We support the concept of expanding the time for this measure for being able to work out differences. I think it's a great bill. The problem with there's an unintended consequence in the original bill draft there, that if we delete lines 12 through 14, it does two things. One thing it does is it would eliminate the situation for standing for the benefit plan organizations or their trusts on there. Earlier in the chapter, there it defines who has standing in the definitions, and that is an individual. It also, I think, calls out SAFE and ODR in it. We did lose a case a number of years back prior to this language actually being put into the statutes over the fact that we did not have standing. This really clarified that the benefit trusts could actually intervene on behalf of the individuals and has been a very useful tool for quite a few years. It also extended out the date about 30 days, and the reason for that and the differentiation on that is that the paperwork trail, after the contractor is paying the employee and the information goes to the employee, if they're not part of the benefit plan trust, they get the information within a certain amount of time. When there's a third-party administrator, a benefit plan administrator involved, the information goes on to the benefit plan administrator, and they're the ones who are looking for the differences in the numbers and to check on the hours situation. So we kind of have a time lag of anywhere from 2 to 3 weeks in processing because another organization is involved that actually does that. And so that was why that extra little bubble was put in for the benefit plan folks, and that was done quite a long time ago by the legislature to help us over a problem that we were having at that time. And so we're asking for that bubble to be put back in, not quite as large. It's listed as 20 days instead of 30 as it was in the past. We think with this overall extension, bringing it out to 200 days would catch us up, and we'd have the same amount of time to actually work the problem. And that's what it comes down to, is that we need a similar amount of time.
Okay, so then, so that would be the dash two.
That would be the dash twos that you have in front of you, and that's the ones that we have requested be put.
Okay. Questions from the committee? Yeah, we are in work session.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 50.
Okay, Senator Starr has moved the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 50. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Any objection to the amendment? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move that the Senate Bill 50 as amended to Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 50 as amended by the dash two to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Okay, so ordered. Anybody like to volunteer for Senate Bill 50? Nice round number. I'll give it to Senator Schrader.
Oh, thank you.
We don't hear from you that much. We want to start hearing from you more.
Okay.
Work session on Senate Bill 170. Mr. Stembridge, you might want to update us on this.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 170, you heard on the 5th of February, it increases from 3 to 6 the number of rural airports eligible for Oregon Department of Aviation pilot projects. This was the through-the-fence economic development projects. You have the dash one, which removes a controversial section there that was the authorization for counties to encourage airport through the fence operations notwithstanding statewide land use planning goals. We have a notice of no revenue impact on the dash ones, and just before the meeting we've got a fiscal statement on the dash one that you should have a copy of near your packet.
Oh, here we go. Is this the one you're talking about?
Yes.
Okay.
Let me just see.
Yes.
Let me
just have this. What is that? Federal government.
Indeterminate.
Okay. Mr. Clem, you want to come forward?
Mr. Chair, members of the Senate Business and Transportation Committee, my name is Dan Clem. I'm the director for the Oregon Department of Aviation. Brought this bill forward and also in supportive of the Dash 1 amendment to continue the pilot program in the Through the Fence program at Aurora Airport. It's now currently at Scappoose Industrial Airpark and also at Baker City Municipal Airport. There are three other airports who have indicated an interest in belonging to the Through the Fence pilot program. This is an important ability for Oregon's airports, particularly rural airports, in establishing that the Through the Fence program can work if it's well regulated, and public-private partnerships underscore the need for meeting the tenants' needs, the local business needs, as well as supporting the airport infrastructure and operations needs. Again, reminded that the Federal Aviation Administration has found through the fence programs problematic because they're not well regulated, because there's an equity issue about who pays to keep the airport open and running. Oregon's through the fence pilot started in 2005 is disproving those issues, and when if and when I attend the Federal Aviation Conference in March, this will be another subject of discussion to help progressively move the FAA's perception of through the fence in a forward and positive manner, and to provide more economic development activity opportunities, if you will. It's completely permissive. The three additional airports would be selected by the Oregon Aviation Board after the essentially the airport sponsors, which in some cases are counties and cities, would apply. And so there's been no pre-selection of who the airports are or you know, whether or not they would qualify. I want to point out that we did expand some of the definitions, and this program would not include airports with a control tower. Control tower airports are generally Part 139 airports that enjoy a whole different set of certification standards, so in and of their nature, they're not rural airports. The definition of rural airport has been increased to a city or standard metropolitan statistical area with a population of 500,000 or more. That number was hard to discern what made sense there, but it made sense that 75,000 would have precluded certain rural airports, and we consider Bend Municipal Airport as a rural airport. Bend doesn't, but in fact, for purposes of this legislation, they'd indicated an interest in this program. So essentially, this through the fence pilot program would make it eligible for all of Oregon's public use airports, for the exception of PDX and those airports that have air traffic control towers, which are really commercial airports. So the Dash 1 amendment removes the really in Section 3 what was the Goal 11 exception process. Clarification between the agency and the Department of Land Conservation and Development was that essentially if you've got industrial zone land already in an airport boundary, you really don't need a change in law. It isn't really necessary. So we appreciate your indulgence and hopefully supporting the Dash 1 amendment to remove that Section 3 and continue the Through the Fence pilot program on to its next phase, and that is letting other communities try it. I will tell you, as the airport sponsor for the Aurora State Airport, the probably the underscoring of the partnership, the public-private partnership, is really what this bill is all about. We meet monthly. We meet with representatives of local governments, county commissioners, city mayors. Friends of French Prairie attend. Charbonneau District attends. We all have robust discussions about how the airport is operated. I fully disclose what the future plans of the airport are. If there are issues to vet, they're vetted there. And in fact, I present the budget for their approval on an annual basis. So I think what it's created is a great partnership that also includes other state agencies, to include DLCD, Department of Land Conservation Development, and also Oregon's Economic Community Development Department. So would recommend that you consider moving this bill forward.
Okay, Mr. Graham, I had a question from the fiscal analysis. It says that currently there are no rural airports as defined by the measure that have available land within the airport boundary for conducting through the fence operations by commercial or industrial users. Is that...
Senator, Mr. Chair, if I could repeat the statement, the LFO has indicated that there are no lands within the airport boundary?
Well, it says, do you not have a copy of the Dash 1? Let me just read it to you. It says, according to the Department of Aviation, there are currently no rural airports as defined by the measure that have available land within the airport boundary for conducting through-the-fence operations by a commercial or industrial user, that the rural airports that meet the criteria of the measure are surrounded by private homeowner or farmland and are not eligible for the pilot program. So I'm just trying to get at it, is that... you are the Department of Aviation, so...
Mr. Chair...
I just want to see if anybody can use this while I'm asking. I read this, I say, well, it's a great bill, nobody can use it, but...
No. Mr. Chair, the Aurora State Airport, 70% of that land is privately owned. and it's commercial.
No, those are current ones, but we're talking prospectively.
Oh.
We're expanding this program.
Sure.
This paragraph seems to suggest maybe no one else is eligible.
No, Mr. Chair, the Bend Airport would be eligible, the John Day Airport would be eligible, and potentially the Brookings Municipal Airport would be eligible.
I think that might want just to be clarified because...
Sure.
It just kind of looks funny, you know. You kind of like, oh, we're going to give you a great opportunity, and nobody's eligible. So, but I, okay, that was my question.
There are at least three airports.
Yes, Senator Verger.
Yes, it's just a little technicality here, but probably one that the public, the community people might want me to change, and that is you're referring to the Coos County Airport as. Coos County, and it is the Southwest Oregon Regional.
Ah. Okay. Okay, we'll
clarify. So noted. Thank you.
Yes.
Any other questions for Mr. Clem? I think what we'll do is there any concern, any of the members, about the bill, other than asking the we will ask fiscal before we go to the floor to meet with Mr. Clem again and just clarify that actually somebody might be able to use the bill.
Yeah, right.
I don't know how to explain that. If not, then we're in a work session with a dash one amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one, the Senate Bill 170.
Senator Starr has moved the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 170. Any discussions? Any objection? Okay, so order.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 170 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 170 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? Ordered. Senator Verger, since you have a nice rural airport, would you like
to
carry the...
I'd be happy to, and you know, Mr. Chair, if you remember, you had to walk pretty hard, I believe it was you, that through the debate on the through-the-fence operation.
Oh, yes.
There was quite a lot of,
very well.
Lot of objections to that.
Yeah. Okay. Let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 22. Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 22 modifies the exemption from the pesticide applicator license for persons maintaining home lawns or gardens. It prohibits exempted persons from applying restricted use pesticides or using power operated equipment. It also requires that property owners or the occupant of the property provide the pesticide application equipment and instructions on the proper and intended use of the pesticide. You have the dash one amendment, which I understand comes from the Department of Agriculture, which makes a couple of clarifications on definitions.
Okay, let's ask Mr. Cross, and is it Galista?
Yes, sir.
And Chris Kirby to come forward first, the first three here. Then we'll get to Mr. Witt.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association, and it's my pleasure to introduce John Galista, one of the members of the Landscape Contractors Association and the chair of their legislative committee, who will review the intentions and reasons for this bill.
Okay. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Metzger and the Business and Transportation Committee. I appreciate your time. My name is John Galista. I've been a member of the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association for 9 years. In 2005, I was president of the State Association, and I currently serve as a legislative chair. I think it's one of the last things you do on your way out of it. But I am also a business owner. Our business is in Hillsboro, Oregon, and we've got four maintenance crews and now one installation crew. And so I personally believe in support of this bill. We feel that this bill will accomplish two things. It'll bring licensed landscape companies to license or not by making pesticide applications as part of their contracts, that they're licensed applicators making the applications. And number two, we're hoping that part of the outcome of this bill is that the cost of the trainee license for the applicators will go a little bit lower. Right now, the cost is equivalent to an applicator's license. And an applicator is versed in the business practices and also carries the insurance for that applicator's license. And so we're hoping that that trainee's license will be reduced a little bit in cost, and also that it can be renewed more than once. Because I know there are employees in my company that don't necessarily want to keep the applicator's license, but it's worth $1 an hour if they have a trainee's license. So the rest of the summary's in the...
All right, well, let's go on to Mr. Kirby, and then we'll talk about it.
Chair Metzger, just real briefly, I want to clarify that the Dash 1 amendments were actually requested by the Landscape Contractors Association based on some conversations we had with the Department of Agriculture, trying to find what home or residence meant, and actually based on some conversations we've had, we'd like to maybe seek further clarification that we're talking about one and two family homes, duplexes, single family homes. Anyway, I just want to clarify that we originated the request for the amendment.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Kirby. I'm an employee of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I serve as the administrator of the Pesticides Division, and we are involved in administering Oregon Revised Statutes Chapter 634, also known as the Oregon Pesticide Control Act. We have provided you with written testimony. I am here to answer any questions that you might have regarding that testimony or our implementation of the Oregon Pesticide Control Act.
Okay. Well, start off with questions. And we have questions for this group of panelists. A moment. Senator Dirk.
I discussed this a little bit in my office with landscapers, but this is to the Department of Ag. As most of my family, not me, has applicator's license, and it's for restricted use pesticides that you can't buy off the shelf. This bill seems to apply to things that you can go and buy at Home Depot. Am I correct on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I believe the type of licensing that you're referring to is the private pesticide applicator license, which authorizes producers of agricultural and forest crops to purchase restricted use pesticides for use on their own property. There is another set of licenses that pertain to businesses that apply pesticides for hire on other people's property. Under existing Oregon statutes, commercial pesticide operators are required to be licensed irregardless of the type of pesticide product that they're using. It pertains to restricted use pesticides as well as to those that you can go and buy at a Fred Meyer store. That's under existing law.
Follow up if I could. Mm-hmm. So what we're talking about here is a situation where so if you had a person could have right now be regulated by you if they bought all of their chemicals at Home Depot and they were doing it commercially?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, that is correct. Existing statutes define a commercial pesticide operator as a business that applies pesticides on the property of another. That pertains to all pesticides, not just restricted use products.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, let's ask Mr. Witt to come forward.
What's the exception?
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, my name is Terry Witt. I'm Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. I'll be very brief. I will not read my testimony. I would just like to highlight a couple things, plus I'm also submitting some testimony for the record from Stefan Gramlich, who is the owner of Beaver Creek Landscape here in Salem. He was unable to make the hearing today. I guess I would like to just kind of paraphrase some of the things in my testimony and point out a few things. The reason that we are supporting this particular measure is basically we want to increase the level of professionalism and product stewardship used by individuals who apply pesticides for hire. And I think the for hire is a very key phrase to consider. And I think we are not in a situation where people are applying pesticides to their own property or in like a farmer. They're working with their neighbor on a cooperative basis. These are people who are in the business, the primary business of landscape maintenance, who are applying pesticides and being paid for it. If you read the statute, now there's kind of an example in here it's kind of unlikely, but because the statute basically says that they are allow this exemption if they do not publicly advertise that they are in the spray business and that it is applying pesticides is not their major work. That means that a person could apply pesticides up to half time, being out for hire, as long as he didn't advertise, as long as he wasn't Acme Spray Company, but he's Acme Landscapers. He could apply pesticides for up to about 1,000 hours a year and not have a license and be perfectly legal. We think that that's a loophole that is a problem. The bottom line, I think, is that I know when I go out and hire somebody and pay them to do a job for me, there's a presumption that, that they have the professionalism to do that job. And I think when someone hires a landscape person to go out and apply a pesticide, they have the presumption that that individual knows what he or she is doing and can do it in a safe and professional manner. And I think, we want to do everything we can to try to make sure that those products that are used by individuals that are doing it for hire do so with the utmost training and knowledge. And I'd just like to kind of point out a little bit, if I could, a few points on Stephen Gramlich's testimony. This is the end of the second paragraph where he says, getting a license with ODA has enhanced his business, not hindered it. And he references that by saying in the third paragraph, using less amount of product is better for my bottom line, better for the environment, and better for my customers who see better results and therefore are happier with my services. I think we're all in the business of trying to protect our environment and do things in the most responsible and safe manner. We think this moves the ball a little bit. It obviously doesn't solve the problem of a homeowner going down and buying materials and using it off-label or using it repeatedly in the wrong manner. It doesn't solve that problem. But it I think, does solve the situation where somebody believes they're getting a professional application done when, in fact, they most likely are not. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Witt. Questions for Mr. Witt? Okay. We're to send a public hearing today. I would ask members to let me know about the bill if there's any other questions about it before we bring it back. Is there anybody else? Nobody else has signed up to testify. Anybody else want to testify on this bill while we have a public hearing open? Okay. We'll close public hearing. And for tomorrow, Mr. Stembridge.
We have four bills. One is a hearing and a work session on Senate Bill 36 from the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners. Transportation Day, so these are all transportation things. We have Senate Bill 414, which is increase the amount of highway funds distributed to counties. Senate Bill 322 on recycling at roadside rest areas. And then we have a work session on a bill that you have heard before on the trucking.
Okay. All right. We will see you tomorrow.
Thank you.
Thank you.